If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Highway to Health Podcast, hosted by Jeremy Quinby, provides guidance, quality resources, and inspiration for anyone seeking wellness in mind, body, and spirit. There's an episode that you should check out called The Value of Our Emotions, where Jeremy helps listeners understand the role emotions serve and what we can learn about our present state by staying attuned to them. Check out Highway to Health Podcast on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Raj Sundar, a family physician and a community organizer. You're listening to Healthcare for Humans, the show dedicated to educating you on how to care for culturally diverse communities so you can be a better healer. This is about everything that you wish you knew to really care for the person in front of you, not just a body system. Let's learn together. This is the truth. In healthcare, certain diseases cast a disproportionate shadow over immigrant and refugee communities. Among them, two really stand out in global statistics: tuberculosis, or TB, and hepatitis B. We're going to talk about this over the next few episodes, but not like how everyone does. While medical education often focuses on the technical part of treatment algorithms and medications, this podcast, as always, takes a different route. So we're going to focus exclusively on the humanity part of it. How to communicate about this complex illness, how to build trust, and how to care for the community experiencing it. Today in this episode, our focus is hepatitis B, a condition that affects millions worldwide, with a significant portion unaware of their infection. I want you to picture this, something that happened to me recently. A patient from East Africa was recently diagnosed with hepatitis B. We sat down, discussed the illness, its implications, and the available treatment options. I thought it was actually going pretty well, and we made significant progress, and even to a point of where he would share with his family. Especially given the context of stigma surrounding this illness, this was huge. But here's where things took a difficult turn. As we talked about hepatitis B and the treatment options, I ultimately told him that he didn't qualify for treatment. That's when confusion clouded his face. "What does that mean?" he asked, a mix of frustration and fear evident in his voice. I stumbled through the explanation, grappling with the guidelines that dictated his eligibility, and just like that, I saw how the chasm between us widened. Just like that, that was the last time I would ever see him. He never returned for further care, leaving me to wonder about all the emotions that probably swirled within him when I was having this discussion. The aftermath of all of that left me with many questions. Was this another example of healthcare privilege, where the marginalized are left behind? Did a skin color play a role in his access to care? I really couldn't imagine everything that was probably going through his head. For him, I could imagine trust in this healthcare system wavered. And I was left questioning how to bridge this gap, how to truly care for those affected by hepatitis B without deepening the chasm of distrust. The episode today is what I wish I had before I had talked to this patient. We hear from Dr. Nina Kim today, who's director of the Translational Research Subcorps of the University of Washington Fred Hutchinson Center for AIDS Research, and is the associate editor of Hepatitis B and Hepatitis C Online. Both are CDC-sponsored web-based curricula and are widely used by physicians and clinicians all around the world. I mean it. If you Google Hepatitis B online curriculum, this is what comes up. Before we go deeper into this discussion, though, let me provide some context. Hepatitis B affects approximately 296 million people, including over 6 million children under the age of 5. And it contributes to an estimated 820,000 deaths every year. It affects a lot of people, and it's an issue that's worth talking about and eradicating. However, only 10% of infected individuals are actually diagnosed, which makes it clear how important it is to increase awareness about this and improve access to care. On top of all this, in the United States, significant inequities persist, as with many, many illnesses. More than 50% of people living with chronic hepatitis B are of Asian, Pacific Islander, or African descent, with Black individuals nearly four times more likely to have chronic hepatitis B and twice as likely to die from it compared to their white counterparts. With all of these sobering statistics, there was actually a call to action by the World Health Organization in 2016, aiming to eliminate hepatitis B as a public health threat by 2030. We still have a long way to go, because the path forward is riddled with challenges, from the complexity of treatment decisions to the need for, as I said before, broader awareness and access to care. But I hope this conversation today becomes an essential resource to achieve that goal by educating you and people like you, as it did for me, how to better talk about hepatitis B to our patients, how to build trust, and how to care for them through it all. Thanks for joining me again. Here's Dr. Kim. Welcome to the show, Nina. I'm excited to talk to you about hepatitis B today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I have been meaning to talk about this because hepatitis B disproportionately affects often immigrant and refugee communities. And I have several patients that live with hepatitis B, and I find it actually one of the most challenging conversations to have. Similar to latent TB.
Yes.
Because it also is connected directly to how it was approached in their home country and what we're saying we do in their quote unquote new country, whether that's Canada, US, wherever. We have sometimes a different way of talking about it, and what treatment means feels different. And then there's a whole category of vaccinations and everything. But I want to first start out actually talking about hepatitis B and how you go about talking about it, specifically with language, because I find that language and the choice of words is really important when we talk about something like this.
Yeah.
So a patient shows up to you and you want to talk about hepatitis B. How do you approach that conversation? And what does the beginning of that conversation look like?
Yeah, so I work at the Harborview Liver Clinic, so it's a specialty clinic. And I think based on my training, initially, I used to just ask them, so how did you come to learn about your hepatitis B? And then I realized that's not the greatest question to start off with, because it centers on the disease and not on the person. And so I actually have switched gears and really start the visit with the primary goal of establishing, like trying to build trust, and really just start by asking them, tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me your story, essentially. Which is very broad, and it's very interesting to see where patients take that question. But you learn a whole lot when you just leave it fairly open-ended, because it's just a reminder to all of us that this infection or the diseases they may have is only one part. It's a tiny fraction of who they really are. But hearing them talk actually gives me an inkling into how much they know. I think a lot of it is really just to start by listening to the patient first and seeing where they are with this. Some patients will come out right off the bat and say, I'm really worried about this. I've been losing sleep. And so a lot of my goal in that first visit is to really de-escalate that stress for them and try to put this in some context that helps them grapple with it. So
a pro tip with, I feel like every conversation is, we are so disease focused.
Very disease focused.
And it's hard. And I always acknowledge the busyness, the rushed feeling that all of our great clinicians feel. But without connecting to people as people, it's hard to actually have that conversation because you don't know where they're starting out. So I appreciate you redirecting us and saying, hey, let's just start out with the person first and then see where they're at and then talking about it.
Yeah. So I really try first by trying to take the sting out of hepatitis B a bit, because there's just a lot out there. There's a lot of stigma, and I'll go back to that, actually. And when I'm talking about hepatitis B, I'm really talking about the chronic long-term infection, meaning the person has not been able to clear the virus. It lives persistently in the liver and is often detectable in the blood. So this chronic form is a silent disease. People don't feel sick. And the main complications of hep B, which is cirrhosis or liver cancer, can take decades before they show up as symptoms. So that's really the crux of it. And trying to make that real, but not make the patient anxious in the process, I think, is a challenge that we face. So I start by sharing the fact that it's a common infection worldwide. The World Health Organization says that there are almost 300 million people living with this infection globally. And I don't often start with those stats, but I share the stats in a more accessible way. I actually start with their home country. If I know where they're coming from, I will say, in your country, one out of every 10 people have this infection. And I let that info sink in because I want to normalize it as much as I can. A huge part of, I think, the stress or personal burden of this infection is patients have this distorted sense that they are alone in this. They're singled out to suffer. And I think that's normal when you hear bad news that you've got a chronic infection. So I do my best to lift this burden for them. And I think it is really comforting to know that it's a shared experience, that a lot of other people have this infection. So that's one of the first things I mention. And then I say that it's an infection for which we do not yet have a cure. It's important to say yet, because a lot of smart people are working on this, but that we have very good tolerated therapy that can keep them healthy and protect their liver. And I also mentioned this is covered by insurance. That's really a key piece in refugee and immigrant communities, is they worry about healthcare costs and see that as a burden that they may have to carry in the process, and that someone may not offer this to them. These are real thoughts that people have. And so a lot of it is trying to walk them through this, because I think you can get into a state of nihilism. Why should I bother to get tested? No one's going to offer me the treatment, or they might not even know that there's a treatment. You never know where people are in the spectrum of their knowledge.
Yeah, I love that. I think what I'm reflecting on is, as a clinician, we have what people call spiels.
Yes.
Of so many things, because I talk about cholesterol all day long. And I then have the same thing that I say to folks. I try to personalize as much, but the fundamental idea of what is cholesterol? Why do we need to treat it? I also think about how many of my spiels could be better.
Oh, yeah.
And because
yeah.
I've gotten used to it. And this idea of what you're saying for hepatitis B, these key words that actually, if you have it in your initial introduction, can disarm folks. They're more willing to listen. Mm-hmm. It's this idea of, hey, there's no cure yet.
Yeah, yet.
And if you don't say that one word, that one single word, and give people hope, they're like, there's no cure. Maybe I don't even want to know about this.
Yeah.
It's, are you just like, give me a death sentence?
Yes.
Hey, there's nothing I can do. And I'm already like spiraling. And like how one word in a spiel can make a difference. And then this idea of, I think, normalizing is also key in that introduction, because I find that some people also have internal thoughts of, even if they don't share, of, hey, are you blaming me? Did I do something? Mm. Oh, there's guilt and shame.
Yeah.
This linked to, I think, a social isolation with different identities too. For men who have sex with men or something, there's already stigma and shame my community's giving. And then now my doctor is telling me I got a disease. And maybe did I do this to myself? Is my community right?
I think the two big questions that patients come in to the appointment with me is how and why. Why is this happening to me? How did it happen to me? And how can I keep my loved ones safe? So transmission is actually a really key piece of education. And so I already know these are some of the key questions. And if they don't have questions for me, I will say a lot of this is confusing. And some of the questions that my other patients have had around this have really been about how and why, and how do I keep others around me safe? And because oftentimes 9 out of 10, that's also something they're worried about, but maybe a little embarrassed about sharing that. So again, this is like normalizing it, putting it in some context, reminding them that they're not alone, that there are other people who are dealing with this and thinking about it. And I think that really opens up for them to talk more about or ask questions, rather than just saying, do you have any questions, after you deliver like a bunch of information?
I know. And everybody's looking at the interpreter. Like, okay, should we just end it? Yeah, I totally get that too. So I think that's great. Creating this idea, first, you're normalizing, as you said, and talking a little bit about cure and what's available and what's not, giving people some hope. And then this idea of transmission too, because it's in people's minds, because people are really community oriented.
Yeah. I did want to make a point about the transmission, because that is often a source of confusion. And it's often a source, that's actually the root of the stigma in part. And you talked about they're already facing other forms of stigma or discrimination in their lives because of their race, their culture. So it is like a double or triple burden for a lot of these patients. And I did also want to say that the stigma and discrimination is real and not just perceived. My patients have told me that they were bullied at school or excluded from family gatherings because of their diagnosis. So many of them choose to keep silent about the disease. In some cases, very few others in their lives know about it. And that's such a lonely place. And that's something I wanted to emphasize, is just that loneliness of having kind of a stigmatizing disease. So that is just something to understand coming in as a care provider, is just realizing that and thinking about what are the ways that I can destigmatize this for folks. When it comes to transmission, I actually say right off the bat, this is not a virus that you can easily spread through sharing a meal with someone or hugging them or living in close contact with them. I start off by saying that because that's such an important part of their understanding. I say that part of the reason why it's more common in their home country is that perinatal transmission is actually one of the main modes of transmission globally. And infants have an immature immune system. They're not often able to clear the virus on their own. So they're more likely to develop chronic infection if they're exposed at this very young age. If they don't receive the vaccine within 24 hours of birth, it's a 90% probability that they'll end up with chronic infection. And that's why we're seeing it more commonly, for example, in Asia, Southeast Asia, and Pacific Islands. In a lot of these countries, birth dose vaccination, which is how we interrupt transmission, is really challenging to deliver. It requires this cold chain storage, and it's just not possible in a lot of settings where home births or midwife delivery is the norm. So that is just some background, like epidemiologically, why we see this uneven distribution of hepatitis B and why it disproportionately affects immigrants and refugees. Really, very much like HIV, is shaped by social determinants of health. It lower or middle income countries are much more likely to have a higher prevalence of hepatitis B. And that's in large part shaped by some of this and by this transmission.
Yeah. I think that's so important. And a few points you made there of sometimes when I hear people talk about stigma, it feels like we just need to convince them to be less stigmatized. Hey, they just need to understand you don't need to have stigma around this. It's almost like the people believe it's just a perception when it's actually a reality.
It is a reality.
Like when people are saying, hey, people are going to not invite me to their parties, again, not to simplify it that way, but just this social isolation, it's real.
It's very real.
So the addressing that root cause is destigmatizing it for the entire community in the appropriate ways, community health workers, community leaders, and that's a different intervention rather than saying, hey, you in front of me, this is nothing to be worried about. And you don't need to have any shame or guilt around this because in America, we just feel like it's another chronic illness. And that could all be important, but I want to emphasize the fact that it's not just perception, that it's real social isolation people are feeling that's leading to
absolutely
the stigma and some barriers.
Absolutely.
I want to back up actually one step of understanding what is hepatitis B even doing to my body. I don't know when you talk about that, because I think when we talk about infections, because it's asymptomatic, there's a lot of explanation that needs to happen. Because when people are feeling ill, they can say, I'm coughing, so something is happening here, right? I'm hurting, so something is happening in this part of my body. Same thing with high blood pressure or latent TB. It's you're telling people they have something, they're like, I feel fine. And now you have to, an abstract concept for hepatitis B, explain about what the liver is, what it could be doing there. You don't feel it. There's a long-term potential consequence to this. So how do you navigate that conversation?
Yeah, I think what you just described, that kind of this concept of silent disease or something that is in your body and it's doing things to your body, but you are not aware of it, is a hard one to grapple with in different cultures. I think I don't love the term health literacy because I think it carries a lot of like colonial overtones to it. But an individual's ability to understand a disease process and appreciate something like the preventive science behind a vaccine is very much shaped by their educational opportunities and their lived experiences. So I think that's going to vary among the communities affected by hepatitis B. If people don't feel sick, they won't see the need to get tested or seek care. They might even doubt the diagnosis. I've had a few patients come to me where they're like, I don't know if I really have this. Do I have this? So there's this underlying skepticism at play. And I think that is really important for us to just acknowledge off the bat and not, as you had said, just when you were referencing the stigma, just saying, minimizing it or saying, oh, you don't have to have stigma. There's something about this as well, just to understand that. So I think part of it is understanding, like in a real way, the skepticism and how do we bridge that gap? How do we create understanding around this? I actually do use a lot of pictures. We've got a poster in our clinic that has like different pictures of the liver. So I actually do walk them through what the virus can do over time. And I emphasize the fact that it's a slowly progressive. And I also put it in some context. And I said, a lot of people don't actually die from their hepatitis B. They might die from a stroke, from their high blood pressure or something else. 1 in 5 people will go on to, if untreated, if unmonitored, will go on to scarring of their liver. And this can all happen without the person knowing it. That's the tricky bit. And I do think showing pictures, showing that this happens, building in that concept that a disease can occur even without you knowing is something that is not going to be achieved in one visit. It may take a few visits, but that's part of the reason why I said the primary goal of the first visit is really establishing trust, like getting an authentic connection with the patient so that they believe you. It's really important for them to understand this so that they can partner with you to stay healthy. This is a big part of it. I have lost people because I don't think that I was able to bridge that skepticism. I didn't gain the trust that I needed to in that first visit. And that just happens sometimes. It is.
Yeah, that's the reality. I like that phrase of bridging skepticism. We're all skeptics, and sure, when it comes to different parts of our life. And when patients come with their lived experience of what sickness and illness means, and you're trying to challenge that idea, saying you're actually sick, even though you don't know it, you have to really hold that perspective and understand how their worldview is completely affected by what you're telling them. And then again, like I have patients like, what else do I not know about my body? Yeah. Are you telling me? I used to think I could trust my body. Now you're saying I have diseases I don't even know about. So when you're talking about silent disease, I think that's one challenge. The other is the idea of risk. Mm-hmm. It's come up in other conversations. I think that's also hard to understand.
The risk conversation is hard. I think this is one I struggle with. How do you convey risk without alarming? How do you educate without alienating? And how do you build trust without overwhelming people, really, like just with information as you're trying to do this? I still struggle with it, I'll be honest with you. The part of it is trying to make this very real. And I will sometimes tell stories to explain that liver cancer is something that we diagnose regularly in their communities. I will bring up a patient who lost her husband to liver cancer without any identifying information. But I do think storytelling has a big place in trying to make this somewhat real for people. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge. It's also important to understand, and we were talking about kind of the skepticism, the cultural alienation that shapes individuals' reluctance to get screened and diagnosed and linked to care. If they don't speak the main language, the English, there's going to be a real sense of vulnerability and skepticism, the sense of separation from the healthcare provider and the system. And that is the gap that we have to bridge. And that's what makes all of these conversations hard.
Yeah. I think tactically, or being very specific on what you do, I also hear that you use visual aids. I acknowledge the value of storytelling because I think we don't acknowledge its importance in different communities. I think it's important for our communities too, but because of our medical paradigm, we like to quote unquote be so objective that we don't make the risk feel real. Mm-hmm. I think you really have to take the perspective of the patient, and varies on how helpful this is, but sometimes I show people the labs and say, this is normal, and this is what you have, because I'm just talking to them saying, you have hepatitis B. They're like, how do you know?
Yes.
Like, what are you talking about? I still don't get it. So I'm like, okay, like this is the normal value, like really printing out and circling. Again, it's like another piece of evidence to respect people's skepticism and saying, yeah, you're skeptical. This is normal. If I was in your place, I would be too. These are all the facts, like evidence we have, and this is what I'm seeing.
No, I love that. I think that's also a very good strategy, is the other interesting thing is our system actually has started to try to encourage patients to sign on to MyChart. And I think some of us in the healthcare field have this sort of bias that if someone doesn't speak English or is not English proficient, that they're not going to sign on to MyChart. I will say that some of my non-English speaking patients are very adept at looking at their labs in MyChart, and they're very curious about them, and as they should be. This reflects what's going on in their bodies. And spending that time going over the data is not in vain. I think it really makes it real for them.
It's important to acknowledge the reality. There's system and structural causes for disproportionate access to, let's say, online care and labs. At the same time, I think we inadvertently bias individuals, meaning saying, hey, you speak Spanish, you speak Mandarin, you probably won't access the chart. So you don't even try when you should give them the same opportunity. Maybe they can't because it is really difficult, but maybe they can. They're like, yeah, I'm good with apps. I just, English is hard, but I can get to my labs. Or, hey, my family really helps me out. My son is a tech genius. If you just involve him, I'm sure we could access everything online and I'll feel more empowered. My son can also talk with me. This idea of giving each individual an opportunity, even when there are structural disparities, I find this really important. And it's important to be mindful and intentional about.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. I have to tell you, one of the joys of doing hepatitis B care is that because it's a chronic illness, I'm following people on their antiviral therapy for years. I've known some of them through a period of time where now their English is better. And so they learn all these things. They become a hep B expert in their own right. And so you see these changes happen longitudinally. So there's always room for growth, both in yourself and in the patient.
So we got the hepatitis B infection. We talked about a little bit about the risk. Next piece for me, which I'm actually curious from your standpoint, is how you even talk about the liver, because it's such a key part of this conversation. Of it's like before med school, I don't know if I knew what really the spleen was, or I still show photos of prostate to all men. I expect people don't know where their prostate is because, you know, you don't really talk about the prostate that much. It's really confusing where it is. So why are you doing a rectal exam to feel my prostate? You said it was up here, right? Yep. So, but I think the liver as an organ and what it does can be really confusing too. I wonder how you talk about that in conjunction with hepatitis B. Is inflammation of the liver caused by a virus called hepatitis B. So that liver part becomes really important.
Yeah. I start off by saying that it's one of their key organs in their body, and it works as both a factory and clearinghouse is the words I use and hope that the interpreter will interpret appropriately. It's taking all the things that you're putting through your gut, the food, your medications, and it's basically taking all that through the bloodstream from the gut and processing it and making some vital substances that your body needs, clearing out some of the waste products. So it does many different functions. So I give a few examples of that. And then I will go to the lab and I will break down what I'm looking at in terms of their liver tests that give me a signal as to whether there's injury and what I'm looking at that is going to be a reflection of how well the liver is working. And one of the ways of de-escalating their worry is showing, hey, your liver is functioning great. And this is how I know. These are the labs that tell me that it's making the things it's supposed to and it's clearing the things that it's supposed to. So when I talk about albumin and bilirubin, I will say that. I will actually point to those labs. And then I will reference the ALT-AST as my way of looking to see if there's some activity or liver injury happening. So walking them through what we're seeing, what we're evaluating. When I'm examining them, I will tell them, this is where your liver is. So part of it is really just walking them through so that they understand. This is, again, one of the ways that we make this real for them, assuming that there's some underlying skepticism about this. Like, how is this real? This is one of the ways we can walk through that reality.
Yep. I like that. I think with the examination, again, I have a lot of skeptical folks listening to often say you don't have time for a lot of things, but this idea of even when you're examining a patient, really explaining to them what you're doing and where the organ is, I think at any opportunity is helpful because there's this power differential that you're always trying to bridge. And as you said, change the abstract concept to something real in their body that they can experience. Okay. So we got the idea of a liver. I want to also acknowledge that you're using what we say a pro tip, right? Using a metaphor of a factory and a clearinghouse. I urge everybody to think about what metaphors they're using specifically with illnesses and with their patients. I do see that oftentimes we use like a war metaphor, like fighting cancer, battling cancer. Yeah. And we don't acknowledge like what that kind of ends up translating or interpreting, right? There's specific emotions and stories associated with that. So being mindful of metaphor is really important, but also in conversations where there's an interpreter involved, and it's such a new concept for folks. I think it's helpful to reflect in your own practice of what metaphors are you using and what are your colleagues using? Could you be doing something different that's more effective or helpful for patients? But I appreciate you calling out what you use for your liver metaphor, factory and liver clearinghouse. I just wanted to note that. So we have the understanding of hepatitis B. Then we talked about a little bit about the diagnosis. We won't go into the weeds of interpreting labs, but let's say now you're transitioning to treatment. You're with the patient who say, okay, I understand hepatitis B, understand I have it. You've been able to build trust and they're about to listen to you about treatment. And then you tell them, you're at a level you don't need treatment.
Yeah.
To give context to folks, there's different criteria for treatment. Not everybody who has chronic hepatitis B gets treatment 100% of the time. And that's also hard to understand because you just told me I'm sick. It took me a long time to get here. And you say there's treatment, but then you're telling me I don't need treatment for it after telling me the risk of progression and all of this, right? How do you just introduce the topic of treatment and talk about this in a way that makes sense to folks?
Yeah, no, I think it's actually one of the areas that I am still struggling with balancing, because I will be honest, the people who I have lost to follow-up are the ones who are not on antiviral therapy, who I had been monitoring. So we have this sort of artificial construct of thinking about hepatitis B in four different phases. And there are the more inactive phases or immune tolerant phases where their ALT, their liver enzymes are normal. So they're not experiencing a lot of hepatitis as we know it in terms of liver injury. These folks don't necessarily need antiviral therapy. And that's according to our current guidelines. There's some debate happening in the field, actually, because we know that antiviral therapy can reduce an individual's risk of liver disease progression to cirrhosis and reduce their risk of liver cancer. There's now more data that has emerged on that front. And so we probably do need to start treating more people than classically fit in to the bucket of having active hepatitis. One of the things I emphasize to patients is that we have this treatment. At the moment, we're not treating everybody. And part of that is I tell people, we don't have a cure yet. What we have is something that controls the virus. But I also put a positive spin on it. I say, if you are an inactive carrier, your viral level is low, your liver enzyme isn't showing any injury, I said, looks like your immune system's controlling the virus pretty well right now. It's got a lid on it. It hasn't cleared it, but it's controlling the level and things are quiet in your liver, right? So use that term. But I also say, it could change. It could change next year. And I need to monitor this because if it does look like things are starting to wake up and become more active, then we think about treatment. So I emphasize that it's a dynamic process. It is a dynamic disease. It can change over a person's lifetime. Yeah. So instead of saying, oh, you're not eligible for treatment or you're not a candidate for treatment, because that kind of denial, it's a hard thing to stomach, especially for some of our patients who are coming from communities that have generally and historically been disenfranchised. It's, oh, this is what I thought it would be.
And whether it's true or not, this underlying feeling, hey, if I was white, would you say, hey, go ahead and take it? Because I might speak up. I might get angry at you, Dr. Kim, and say, hey, there's debate about hepatitis B right now. So I want you to prescribe it to me, right? Yeah. And because me, I just have to listen to you. And that feeling is real.
Yeah. And in their home country, perhaps only those individuals with means have gotten medications. This is the people's lived reality. So there's this nihilism. Oh, why bother? Why bother coming to see the doc? They're not necessarily going to offer treatment to me. We have to acknowledge that this is what people have lived through. So I emphasize the fact that their immune system has good control over this now, but it might be different later. Mm-hmm. So I'm emphasizing that monitoring is part of the care. If they need liver cancer screening, I spend some time talking about that. So it's an interesting juxtaposition. You're saying, okay, you've got this infection. I can't do anything about it now, but I don't emphasize the negative part, like you're not going to get therapy. I can't do anything now. I say, hey, your immune system's got good control over this, but we still need to keep an eye out for things because this may change and you might need medication later. And then if you do, we catch it early. And so that,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's a different reframing, but I think it's really important.
I feel like I just got better at talking about this. I appreciate this idea. And to also note again, the metaphors you're using to make it more understandable, this idea of putting a lid on something, like it's controlled, your body's controlling it. Or I think you also use maybe like sleepy. It's like your virus is dormant. You're trying to get at that idea of it's controlled, it's not active. In latent TB, I think some people really resonate with the idea of it's like the virus is sleeping. Again, with metaphors, want to toe the line of accuracy versus simplicity.
Right.
Because sleepy is something people can readily understand, and maybe that makes sense. So you need to monitor it because it could wake up. That's use those words at any time.
Yeah, I'm still tweaking how I talk about this, but I think that phrase of waking and sleeping and quiet has resonated with patients. They seem to understand because the idea is it's still there. When I use those terms, it's not saying it's gone or that it's a static situation because we're not going to sleep forever. We're going to at some point wake up.
Yep, yep.
So that so I like that metaphor largely because there's like this dynamic aspect that it can change later on.
I don't know.
We'll see. There are times when I feel like asking, because occasionally like my patients come with their younger family members, their children who speak English really well. And I occasionally feel like asking them, hey, do you think this landed okay? I don't know.
Yeah, I do feel like there needs to be some kind of community of practice with interpreters and clinicians.
Yes.
I think I appreciate that. I think naturally the next questions that many of my patients have is, let's just talk about, hey, your immune system's doing great, you don't need treatment. And then they ask, what can I do by myself to make sure it doesn't wake up? Oh, it's where I find sometimes clinician dismiss because there's not actually specific things you can do, like diet necessarily, what people often think of. But we want to give patients the sense of empowerment of, hey, it's good to do blank things that could be helpful. Yeah. It's when I hear patients, they want to be able to do something.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, actually, because that aspect of how do I protect my liver? What can I do? What's in my power to do? It's such an important ask. And we need to respond to it in a way that empowers people to take agency over their disease. Mm-hmm. And I actually think there's a couple of themes we can emphasize. I tell patients that alcohol is a no, and I go through them why. Alcohol is one of these substances that's just such a part of our social fabric. It's so easily accessible, but it is one of the things that's reliably out there that could injure the liver. You know, your liver's already dealing with a chronic infection. Not to be alarmist, but I give patients the idea that it's like adding gasoline to the fire. You don't really want to go there.
Yeah.
So I
look at the Dr. Kim, you can't help yourself. So many metaphors. It just keeps coming. I'm just kidding.
Well, part of it is do you make this vivid for people? Alcohol is just, it's so socially acceptable. Some of our Asian patients, for example, they don't process enzymes out when they flush. So it's not a big deal. Yeah. I don't ever want to assume. And so I will say, I will actually spend some time telling people that's like the one thing that's out there that you really want to be careful about. I actually also spend some time telling patients that one of the ways to keep their liver healthy is to actually make sure they're getting exercise and trying to aim for a normal weight range if they can, like trying not to gain too much. I also bring up the fact that coming to the United States, like a lot of our immigrant patients have gained weight because food is so accessible. Yeah. High caloric snacks are just so readily available. So this is a reality that is well known in these communities who are already dealing with diabetes and may have some component of fatty liver or steatotic liver disease. So I tell them that doing regular exercise every day, like making sure you're not hitting greasy foods or fatty foods too much, those things actually help your liver. And I do more teaching around that over the course of the visits, but that is actually something positive for them to do. That is definitely been shown to benefit the liver. So yeah, at the moment, we don't have a really directed treatment for fatty liver disease, but fatty liver disease is pretty prevalent in these immigrant and refugee communities, especially those that have like their body mass index have increased since moving to this country.
Yeah, I love it. I think I have a good sense of the conversation at a one-on-one level and communication about this topic. Did we miss anything with specifically communication and language that you want to?
I want to go back to what we had talked about before. Like, you were talking about the war metaphor of, like, we do use military metaphors
a lot
in medicine. And I want to also just bring up the fact that some of our patients, their people have had a background of historical trauma faced in their homeland before they journey to the United States. And there are a lot of reasons why different immigrant community members are not necessarily going to trust a U.S.-based provider. One of the examples I want to bring up is we have a growing community of people from the Marshall Islands, and Hep B is very prevalent in this group. And I only just learned this history, but one of my residents reminded me that the U.S. conducted atomic bomb testing during the 1940s and 60s, practically decimating whole islands and displacing hundreds of Marshallese people. And it was just, you know, a devastation of the highest order. So after something like that, which didn't happen that long ago, how can we really expect anything but distrust? So I think understanding that historical context and understanding why we need to build trust, I think, is part of all this. And then being careful with the warfare metaphors, because they can strike hard in some of our patients who've actually lived through some of this. The other thing I was going to mention is we had talked a bit about the fact that in our medical training, we think a lot about problems and pathology and prescribing, and it's such a negative framing, and it's not very empowering to the patient. I will bring up an example in terms of our communication and messaging around hepatitis B. So San Francisco, they have a lot of Asian Americans, and they have had Hep B messaging campaigns over the years. They actually had a public service message poster a number of years back that showed a row of Asian beauty pageant contestants with the question, who deserves to die, as part of their Hep B campaign messaging, which is so problematic on multiple fronts, apart from the fact that there's this like disturbing overtone of misogyny in there. But I think this is my way of saying we're learning, we're getting better, because now San Francisco's more recent Hep B campaign messaging has featured prominent Asian community figures. Their city supervisor, Fiona Ma, who lives with chronic hepatitis B, is seen in a poster with a superhero cape with the slogan, "Be a Hero," where the B is the letter B. And I'm just thinking about how far we've come in terms of creating more inspiring and motivating messages. And I'm bringing that as a more obvious example, but we can do it in a smaller scale and just in terms of our interactions with patients.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. We sometimes default to instilling fear as the way to get people to act. That, hey, if we just scared them enough, maybe they would listen to us. We don't acknowledge the root cause. I think in this example, the true stigma that's in the community, it's not that they need to really be scared of dying any moment from hepatitis B in order to come in. But there's a lot of complicating factors, including this normalizing that, hey, you can do great things like this person and who's living with hepatitis B, and she's still doing it. And she's very popular. You see it in TV. People aren't like standing far away from her, even though everybody knows this. It gets to more of the causes and where the true barriers are. And I think it's easier to get there if it's community-led, which is what we often talk about too, versus me sitting in some room designing a masterful plan to get the community to get a hepatitis B screening.
The other theme I wanted to bring up, and maybe this is getting into a question you'll have about what resources there might be for clinicians. The Washington State Department of Health has put in a lot of effort to try to they've created a whole bevy, like this amazing library of relatively digestible two-sided page brochures looking at all different aspects. One of my favorites is how to live with chronic hepatitis B, and it's in over 20 languages. I think it's getting close to 30 languages. I love it. I'm regularly on that site printing out brochures for people. Because we share all this information, but most of the time people aren't going to remember all of it. And it's nice for them to have something in their home language that sort of walks them through, how do I care for my liver? What are the things that I can do in my day to day? And so if you Google Hep B Hub, it's one of the top Google hits. And yeah, I'd encourage people to check that out. The other plug I wanted to make is University of Washington Hepatitis B Online. So it's a free web-based curriculum. You could get free CNE, CME. It's a library of different lessons, and it includes graphic pictures of the liver, if you wanted to use that. And I encourage you to check it out, because I think a large part of talking about this is first start by getting comfortable talking and counseling about this, because I think Hep B can be intimidating to understand. And so those are a couple of resources that I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And we were talking about this earlier, that your work is so well known that if you just Google, it often is in the first two pages, just hepatitis B curriculum. I think I've talked to a lot of people, and the curriculum that you just mentioned by University of Washington and the resources that the Department of Health have created are excellent and often are listed in outside of the state in many other places. So appreciate that call out. And I think it's important for people to know, to get comfortable before digging deep into this language piece of it, because I think comfort is the first step.
One other thing, and this is more for patients, is the Hepatitis B Foundation does a lot of advocacy work in this space, and they have this wonderful storytelling platform. And we were talking about storytelling, but I think I have been starting to send patients over there because it's quite powerful. They have these 2 or 3 minute videos, mini videos, where people share their story. And they're quite powerful. It enables people to see themselves and their own humanity and in their journey with this infection. And just going back to something I said before, that it's much less isolating when you know that there are other people out there who are dealing with this. So it is creating this sort of online community, as it were. But I encourage providers to check that out. Share it with your patients.
Thank you. Thanks for the specificity of that. I'll definitely have to look at that too. Okay, so we have some resources. We touched upon a few other things. We talked a little bit about the stigma, and we only touched upon some of the factors in the stigma, which is social isolation. Do you feel like there are other factors that contribute to the stigma that people need to be aware of? And anything that you've seen be successful outside of what we talked about in addressing that?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think part of what compounds the stigma is the silence around this infection. I think if you have reached a point when you have built trust with the patient, I think I have started gently nudging folks to share their diagnosis or tell their story to when they feel it's safe to do with family members. It's a hard one. This is one of the harder things we have to ask patients to do. And I think we do need to do that because in a lot of cases, as I mentioned, like perinatal transmission is the common modality. So it could be that their brother over 3 states over also has chronic hepatitis B. So that's a tough extra burden for our patients to have. But I tell patients that I believe in them, that this is a hard thing, but I know that they could do it. And it's something that I'm not asking them to do it right now. They can think about it, but it is sharing the whole process of talking about it, sharing this, empowering them to keep their family members safe. I would not underestimate that. And part of what you're doing is you're asking them to break the silence around this, because silence is what breeds stigma. We're like having the sunshine and the light come in, and we're not concealing this. We're talking about it.
Yeah.
And we're empowering people to do something about it. And so I think that's a really important part of destigmatizing this. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's true. Is there anything organizations, specifically healthcare organizations, could or should be doing as part of this that you think it's important for people to advocate for if they're not a leader or if they're part of the administration to work towards?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I think it's really critical that healthcare organizations prioritize high quality interpreter services. That's been hit or miss. King County, like 1 in 5 people are coming from these countries that have high prevalence of latent TB, of chronic hepatitis B. Like, we need to know who we're serving. We need to understand the communities we serve. And I think I've also been thinking a lot about how do we decolonialize our healthcare system? How do we shift the power dynamics in all of this? And I think a large part of this is bringing in community members, ensuring that they have a real voice in our programs and how we communicate and deliver care. I think more of our hospital boards need to include these community members. So that's a real part of all this. December 1 was just recently World AIDS Day, and the theme that UNAIDS put forth for us when we're thinking about addressing the HIV epidemic is letting communities lead. So that's the theme of this year's World AIDS Day. And I think that theme is something we can also carry out in the viral hepatitis field, is that we really need to give community members a voice in all of this. If we're going to create like an amazing program that really meets their needs, like we need to hear from them. If we're going to create materials that bridge these gaps, we need to hear whether not just the language we use is like appropriate, but like our word choice, how we frame the problem, whether that is culturally appropriate. So it takes a little effort in this. Like I just talked about the fact that Washington Department of Health put out like something with 30 languages. That's a lot of languages. But I think it's so important to do this work.
Yeah, thank you. We end the podcast with a similar question, and I'll modify it for this specific topic, which is, have you had a situation, you, your family member or colleague, where approaching hepatitis B in a culturally responsive way ended up working out really well that you wanted to highlight, or something that didn't work well at all and it was a lesson learned when it comes to this topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel very privileged in doing this work because I get to see patients when they start off, not even sure that they have this infection, to really embracing it in some ways and realizing that they can do something about this and they can help others in this process. It's like looking beyond yourself, like that part, as I was mentioning, bringing their other family members in to get tested and doing that journey of, like, gosh, I really don't want this disease. Why did this happen to me? I really don't want to deal with this.
Yeah, that's an important step of this process. I agree. Dr. Kim, thank you again for joining us. I learned a lot. I'm sure our audience did too. And it almost sounds like we got to have you back, maybe to talk about HIV or hepatitis C. Thanks again, everyone, for joining me on another episode of Healthcare for Humans. If you liked this episode, as always, my ask to you is please share it with one other person and go to healthcareforhumans.org to sign up to be part of the community. And lastly, thank you to Tessa Chu for helping co-produce this podcast. I'll see you next time.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Highway to Health Podcast, hosted by Jeremy Quinby, provides guidance, quality resources, and inspiration for anyone seeking wellness in mind, body, and spirit. There's an episode that you should check out called The Value of Our Emotions, where Jeremy helps listeners understand the role emotions serve and what we can learn about our present state by staying attuned to them. Check out Highway to Health Podcast on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.